Welcome to the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast, produced by OOT Social Health, where the focus is on exploring the essential elements that drive organizational success, human-centric leadership. Hosted by Adjoa Boahidi, principal of AKB Talent Edge. Neil Milliken is a global leader in digital accessibility, inclusion, and assistive technology. As the VP, Global Head of Accessibility at Atos, he spearheads initiatives integrating accessibility into digital transformation strategies for enterprises worldwide. He is also a board member of the World Institute on Disability, a co-founder of Access Chat, and a member of IAAP Global Leadership Council. Actively shaping inclusive workplace strategies, digital accessibility policies, and assistive technology adoption. Welcome, Neil.
Wow, thank you. It's great to be with you. And I'm sorry for twisting your tongue on some of those things. So really glad to be with you today.
There were a lot of big words in those sentences. So before we talk about the role of accessibility in shaping the future of work and what steps organizations should take to embed accessibility into business strategy, we want to get to know you a little bit as a person, Neil. And the way we do it is I'm going to ask you a couple of Proust questions from his questionnaire. As Marcel Proust, the essayist, believed that the answers to these questions will allow us to get to know you and your true nature better. Are you ready for your first question?
Ready as I'll ever be.
There we go. Which talent would you most like to have, Neil?
I would like to have a talent of helping people come together and building community. I think that a talent of convening and diplomacy is a talent that I value highly.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. And I think it is actually reflective perhaps in some of the work that you do as well. So we'll explore that a little bit. If you were to die and come back as a person or a thing, what would it be, Neil?
Oh, that is a really tough question. As an animal, maybe one of my previous pet dogs, because they lived a very pampered life and had to do very little work. I think that if I was to be a thing, I would like to be some kind of technology, again, some kind of like AI translation tool, because again, like having grown up like living with science fiction novels and so on, I was actually very much a techno-optimist when I was growing up. I think that the technology is much more nuanced now, but I do still love the enablement powers of technology. And I think that, you know, maybe I'm the babe. I would like to be the babel fish. That's what I'd like to be.
Neat, neat. And so I was thinking maybe you would say you wanted to be Hal.
No. Maybe if you've seen Red Dwarf, I'd like to be Holly.
Yeah, I don't know. I actually know that one. You caught me on that one, Neil. You caught me on that one.
With a BBC comedy about people being out in space, and Holly with E. Holographic interface for a computer, and it was very sarcastic and maudlin.
As good British humor is.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's get to the heart of the matter and talk about accessibility and strategy. So you've been a strong advocate for embedding accessibility into business strategy. What might be the biggest misconception companies have as it relates to accessibility? And what's your message to leaders who still think of it perhaps sometimes as an afterthought?
I think that they're not just thinking about it as an afterthought. The reality for a lot of people is that accessibility is unfortunately still an afterthought. I think the other thing that I would like to disabuse leaders of is the idea that accessibility is a cost and only a cost. Actually, done right, it is actually revenue positive for organizations. There is a very high return on investment on inclusion. And now that requires it being planned and integrated into business practices, but actually there are more benefits. So it's an investment and not a cost. And there is a return on that investment. And that often people only see the cost. And frequently, because it's an afterthought, then they're incurring the cost, and the costs are really high. Whereas if you plan for it, you're actually building things that work for people, you're creating inclusive workplaces, you're unleashing talent, you're reducing employee churn, all of the kind of things that business leaders are actively looking to do. These are the things that they're targeting in their strategy.
So it's about creating also greater engagement and productivity, right? So that's where the return comes into play, is if you have an accessible organization, people are going to be more engaged and more productive.
Yeah, all sorts of things. I mean, people, particularly, the millennial generation and Generation Z are very much focused not just on what their take-home pay is, but what the kind of organization they're working for. Mm-hmm. So an inclusive organization is part of your employee value proposition. Mm-hmm. One that welcomes and supports everyone is an attractive place to work. So when you're, a sort of, not everybody can be one of the sort of really major tech companies with great name recognition. So how are you then going to attract your talent? Well, you've got to find other ways. And having a good reputation for being inclusive and innovating on things like accessibility and inclusion is a really good way of attracting and retaining the talent that people are really struggling to find.
Absolutely. I mean, I used to always talk to leaders about that it's a must-have, not a nice-to-have, right? That notion of inclusion or being an organization that's inclusive and diverse is a must-have for millennials and Gen Z.
Yes, it is. But it's also a must-have for effectiveness for an organization.
Fair. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So some organizations follow that train of thought a little bit. So it's either an afterthought, or they sometimes see it as a compliance checkbox exercise rather than an innovation driver. So how can businesses move beyond this notion of compliance? Maybe you can give us some examples of embracing accessibility as a competitive advantage beyond sort of the labor pool draw.
Okay. Well, compliance in itself is not a bad thing. There's a lot that are struggling even to do that. Okay. But it's not the end goal. It shouldn't be the end goal. Right? Compliance is the baseline. And what you really want to do is then build a culture and technologies and an ecosystem that people are working in is where they can thrive. And some of the sort of examples of innovation that we've done within our own organization was early in the days of COVID, right? People were trying to adjust to home working and remote working and stuff like that. We were the first part of our organization to run a remote hackathon. So we did a hackathon. We did it fully remote. We did it internationally. We attracted support from lots of different organizations, and we were able to find and create innovative solutions in a new way. And actually, we facilitated that because actually people with disabilities have been saying that we would need home working for years, right? Only to the point that it was possible. But, and I think that's something with all of the sort of return to office push at the moment, where we have a risk that we're starting to exclude people again that had been included.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That was one example of innovation, but we also are early adopters of technology, because if you have a disability, you're constantly problem solving because you're presented in a world that was not designed for you. So you're always encountering barriers, and those barriers aren't necessarily put there intentionally, but you encounter a barrier and you have to problem solve your way around it. And
right.
When new technology comes out, people with disabilities tend to be looking at that and going, well, how can I apply that to solve the challenges that I'm facing? So a great example is, nowadays we're all used to talking to our computers. Everybody shouts at Siri and Alexa and all of the other devices. And now they answer back. But when I first started in this space 25 years ago, we were doing speech recognition systems for people with dyslexia. And other disabilities. And really there were only three groups using speech recognition at the time because it was a bit clunky, and it was lawyers, doctors, and people with disabilities, because the lawyers and the doctors were used to dictating, and they had a return on their investment because they were shaving on the typing tool. And the people with disabilities, it was enabling them to do stuff that they would otherwise find extremely difficult and impossible to do. So we stuck with those technologies, and it was sort of disability that's driven the creation of the better speech recognition, the speech and the voices and the interfaces, and all of the sort of work in large language models that are now ubiquitous in what we are calling AI. Those technologies and the early use of them was powered by the use of that, you know, by people with disability. So we're often at the bleeding edge of technology, early adopters, and also great beta testers, and we don't abandon the tech. And because we don't abandon the tech, that means you're going to be able to get deeper insights into how the technology works and how it might be applied than people who go, oh, well, it didn't work for me. And then you sort of, you have this sort of hype cycle, and then stuff drops off a cliff because everybody goes, oh, actually, it's too hard.
It is super interesting. And I'll reveal that my daughter has dyslexia. And so in the school system, she's starting to use speech to text. And it's so empowering, right? Never mind in the school system, and that will allow her to continue to school, because 20, 30 years ago, she would have, you know, I don't know what would have happened to her, but I suspect it would not have been great. And so now she has a world of possibilities available to her that then will also then translate into the workplace, right? Because it just opens up the pool. And we view people who have something like dyslexia completely differently. It's not, you know, in the past, again, it was related to intelligence. And now we know that that has nothing to do with somebody's capabilities.
I dictated all of my MBA.
Wow.
So I used assistive tech for all of my MBA submissions, including my exams. I was lucky enough. They had someone proctor me and sit there, make sure I wasn't cheating. But I dictated all of my exams. What you don't want to do is turn around to the invigilator, the proctor, with your microphone still on and the text highlighted, and say, how much time have I got left, and overwrite your entire answer.
Oh, dear.
I had taught the software to swear, and it did transcribe all of my swearing whilst I was remembering to undo. So that's a life lesson learned. But yes. Speech recognition technology is super useful, fantastic for people with dyslexia. It's also great for people with mobility issues. And the thing is, the difference now is that actually everybody's yelling at their phone the whole time. They're yelling at devices. It's no longer seen as unusual. Whereas 20 years ago, when I was sat in an office shouting at my computer, people took the mic out of me.
Right. So I wanted to ask you about leadership later, but I think it actually is really great to bring it up now. So how do you help leaders understand the use of these sort of tools? Or is it easier now because the average bear or the person who doesn't maybe have any challenges in that regard also uses it? So how do you speak to leaders about this and get them to understand that this is such a rich opportunity, rather than, again, whether it's cost or, you know, is that person really capable if they need this kind of these kinds of tools?
Yeah, I think you have to start with listening. So you need, there's lots of different types of leaders in organizations, and you need to really understand what makes that person tick before you address your argument. Because if you go in with this is a human rights argument, and you're talking to the CFO.
Right.
I'm not saying that CFO don't care about human rights.
Yeah, it's careful, Neil.
If we were to generalize, they're more focused on what the return on investment will be, right? So I think that you need to understand what your audience is, whether it's a technical audience so you can get them excited about the technology, or whether it's, you know, It's about the human potential that you're unleashing if you're talking to HR, or the fact that you're going to reduce the sickness absence and you're going to have better retention and all of the employee value proposition that I talked about before. Or, you know, is it actually, you know, part of how you portray your organization? You know, is it part of your CSR strategy? And there are good arguments that you can make for all of these things, but you need to tailor that discussion to the individual. So I don't think you can have a monolithic approach to how you describe the benefits of accessibility, because you really need to be thinking about the context in which you're addressing that for the managers. Within our own organization, we do have frameworks, so it's not like everything is freewheeling. Right. But we have a framework, and Atos as a company has been extremely good at sort of the environmental side of things for a long time. And so on top of, you know, our sort of sustainability policies, we're CDPA rated, DPSI, all of these kind of things. We're highly ranked for our industry. And we've been doing this for a very long time in terms of reducing energy consumption before it became something that companies were doing. And so when I was trying to work out how could I get an enormous organization, because we're in 70 countries, and at the time I started, we had over 100,000 employees. How do you make this thing work across an organization as complex as that? And I looked at the things that the organization did well and that people understood, and actually, you know, sustainability was one of those things that we were excellent at, and that it was part of the organizational DEA and DNA, and people were really into it. And then if you think about it, when we're doing decarbonization, there is an economic concept behind it, and that's the concept of externalities, right? So when you are making products or services and stuff like that, if you make a product and service, there's usually an output, and if you don't take care of that output, it's pollution, and that's a negative externality. And so everybody's trying to reduce their carbon emissions and their energy consumption to reduce those negative externalities. In the same way, if you produce a product or a service that excludes someone and you're not part of the fixing, then that's a negative externality in the same way pollution is. And frequently when people make products and services that are inaccessible, it's not them that pays, it's the individual or it's the state that then has to pay in order to make workarounds and support the individuals. So that's a negative externality. So we took the framework from sustainability and we say we're treating exclusion like pollution, and then we're actually following the same three scopes that you would for decarbonization to build our corporate programs around. So it's the direct scope one, direct. So it's stuff that we make and control ourselves. We then have to make and try and build that accessible and be more and more inclusive. Then the second of those is, you know, stuff we buy. So our supply chain, scope two. You know, that's influence. So we influence our supply chain and our partners. We work with them. We put in procurement requirements. We educate them. So we support them. We hold trainings for our suppliers on this stuff. We measure them on all this kind of stuff. And then the third scope is the widest of those scopes is the sort of upstream and downstream impacts of accessibility and inaccessibility. And so we work with the third sector. We work with like the International Association of Accessibility Professionals, you know, building these kind of alliances so that we're creating an ecosystem which is more and more inclusive, because actually we're in a very interconnected world.
Great.
And as a digital transformation provider, we're an old school systems integrator for a lot of the stuff we did. So we're working with other people's products. And so we have to help them become more accessible. We have to know how to configure them. We also have to educate our clients that they need to be buying accessible because they have a responsibility to their workforce and to their end users or whatever. And so it's a really wide piece. And one of the reasons why I like working for an organization like this is that you get your tentacles into lots of different places. So you can use the fact that you are working with so many different organizations to leverage significant change outside of your organization as well as inside.
Right. It's really full circle, as you said, right? The inside, the internal, what you control, as well as then broadening those concentric circles further out to developing an ecosystem that all focuses more, not just on do no harm in some ways, but also do good, right? Yes. Do good, do better.
Yeah. So I talk about wanting to make good money from doing good things. We shouldn't be ashamed of making money from inclusive products and services or disability specific services. We shouldn't be charging end users more for that, right?
Right.
Because that's problematic. But there is no harm in, especially in a B2B kind of scenario, of us charging for those services to our customers. So long as the individual is not penalized financially, then there is no reason why, given that we've already stated what the return on that investment is, why would we charge for it?
Yeah.
So then it becomes framing about, well, why shouldn't we make more money from doing the good things than the bad things in business, you know, and really think about ethical business and ethical business practices. And I think that the ethical business is a real issue for technology at the moment because of the power of technology. You know, we're on the cusp of, you know, a significant change in how we apply technology. We're just starting that with some of these large language models and agentic AI and all of these decision-making processes. And so, yes, we can implement these things and we can make stuff happen, but we need to think about the consequences of the things we think we're going to make happen, because you can bet your bottom dollar that some of the things we didn't think about are also going to happen.
For sure, which is a great segue, actually, Neil, to the question that let's talk about AI. I mean, in this day and age, you can't have any conversation without, right? Also bringing in the concept of AI or the world we live in now, is what risks and opportunities or consequences do you see as it presents for accessibility work?
Well, the language models, as we talked about a little bit before, are the things behind speech recognition and text-to-speech. So they've been around for a long time. What we call AI now is sort of built upon layer of other, you know, machine learning tooling. And so what we've created is something that we've somewhat anthropomorphized, because we think of it as intelligent, whereas it's actually a language model. But as we start using AI for decision-making, or for creating content and things, then we have a responsibility to be thinking about the impacts of people with disabilities, but also other minority groups. Because when we are using historical data, what's actually happening is we're building in all of the historical biases that are in society already.
Yes.
So there are great potential for AI to be super useful. As a dyslexic ADHDer, some of the things that are available now, like transcripts, inferred meeting notes and actions and stuff like this, fantastic. This is the biggest development in technology that assists people with cognitive disabilities in the 25 years that I've been working in this space, because it's been pretty much static. For most of my time, it was speech recognition, text-to-speech, spell checking, and a bit of sort of mind mapping. And those tools were pretty static. And suddenly, you've got virtual assistants, you've got all kinds of new and exciting tools that help you with your memory and your executive functioning and stuff like this. But then, when it comes to those decision-making tools, then you've got to think really carefully, because those decision-making tools are being deployed by government agencies and organizations, and they impact people's life chances. So you've probably heard or read about, you know, the AI powered hand dryers that would only dry white hands, or facial recognition tools that didn't recognize faces of different ethnicities. So that was one. I think it was the UK passports where you could actually, it's a really good service, by the way. You can get a new passport really quickly by uploading your photo and looking through your webcam and doing the facial recognition, and suddenly, wonderfully, within 10 days, you have a new passport instead of waiting weeks and months for a manual process. But it didn't work for people of certain ethnicities. So that showed that the historical data was...
They don't. That's right. Or what it was trained on, as they say,
But that's reflective of the bias in the data that's on the internet. And that's the case if you're looking at imagery of people with disabilities, for example. You hardly ever see disabled people on the internet. We're not represented. We're not represented in the media. We're not represented in advertising, or disproportionately not represented. There are cases, right? Sure. Everyone can say, oh, yeah, well, there was Marty Maitland in this movie. You know, there was the Maltesers advert or whatever back in the UK, but not many, right? We're 15, 16% of the global population, more in North America. Something like 20% of American citizens actually have a disability or long-term health condition. And that's not represented in the imagery. So
I'm going to bring you along to, actually, maybe this is, we'll segue now to Access Chat. So maybe you can tell and describe a little bit, because this is about creating a platform by which, they're increasing representation and really educating and creating awareness, like I'm assuming. So what is Access Chat, and what's sort of next? What do you envision is the next stage for?
Okay. So it started out as video interviews and Twitter chat back in the day. Oh, old school Twitter. So it was something that we've been doing for over 10 years now. So a weekly video podcast and Twitter chat, which is now a social media chat on a different platform. Yeah. So we're on Blue Sky now, which is very similar in functionalities to what old Twitter was. It's very open. So you can have a Q&A and it can be very open, and some of the other social media platforms just don't allow that real-time discussion. We also do it in podcast format now. So we invite guests on to talk about innovation in disability inclusion, disability issues, technology, and so on. And we've been doing it for 10-plus years, 500 interviews. And it was a great way for me and my co-host to learn. Right? Because when we started out, actually, there weren't many people working in the space. And if you're working in a big company, you were probably the only person in a big company working on the topic. So what do? You can't reach out to your colleagues to get the knowledge. You have to reach out externally and go outside. And part of that has been around community building, learning from the community, bringing people together. And certainly in the early days of Twitter, we built a significant community. There were vibrant discussions. Social media is a place where people with disabilities were able to meet and socialize and do stuff that often they couldn't do elsewhere, right? Again, if you have a condition that's not that common, you may not know anyone in your area that has that condition, so you can't talk about it. The internet opens all of that up. Requires if you have mobility issues, you can't attend events, but you can have discussions online. So we've built friendships, professional relationships, networks. It's been a really enabling opportunity to grow the accessibility network and profession, and along the way also meet and interview wonderful people from the wider community. So highlights have been interviews on mental health with Stephen Fry, the actor and comedian and author. We got to interview the vice president of Argentina from the Argentine equivalent of the White House. It's the Pink House. That was pretty cool. Hollywood actors, U.S. senators, lawmakers. Amazing. People are building new technologies. And then also people that are practitioners as well. So we also really want the people that are doing the work in at the coalface,
right,
coming and talking about their work. So it's a real mix. We're not starstruck.
Yeah.
We want to actually highlight the people that are doing the real work, because that's also where we hear about the innovations first.
So speaking of real work, I'm a leader with my team. I'd like you to think, and it wasn't actually in the document, but I'm sure, Neil, that given that you live and breathe this, you'll be able to answer this without any concern. I'm a leader and I have a team, and sometimes I may not even know, right? Because to your point, if it's, you know, dyslexia or something, I may not know unless somebody discloses it. It may be an invisible, so to speak, disability. What practical advice do you want to give leaders about how to create that inclusion, through accessibility? What are practical things that I can do as a leader to build that inclusive culture?
So you do start by walking the talk on being inclusive. So you've done some of it yourself. You talked about your daughter's experience. So you're signaling that you're going to be an ally, right? But then you also need to start communicating that this is something that you value, that you want to support, and show that you support it. And it can't be a once a year thing, you know.
At the annual meeting, yeah.
In the sort of space of standing up employee networks and, you know, the DEI calendar, as it used to be, it's full of dates, right? And often those days are overlapping, and people go and make a statement on a day, or they make a tweet or a post something on LinkedIn, and then it's done for the year. This needs to be consistent practice, inclusive practice. And inclusive leadership is everyday leadership. And it's about really showing people that this is something that you value. And what happens over time is you get a snowball effect, because other people start showing that they care, and they start coming out about their hidden disabilities. In a similar way to the LGBTQIA movement, mm-hmm. where, you know, you can be in the closet about your disability because it's not obvious.
Right.
Then people don't feel comfortable to disclose because they're afraid that the organization is not only going to not support them, but actively act against them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you need to be able to demonstrate that allyship and that genuine support. And when people start seeing that, and they start telling their stories, and they start saying, "Well, and this helped and worked for me," then you start creating a culture where other people feel comfortable. And it does require the leaders to do it. I spent a bit of time in my organization saying, "Surely I can't be the only disabled manager in my organization." Now we have really other senior leaders within the organization talking about their own conditions or why it is meaningful for them. Those are the kind of things that culture change doesn't happen overnight. And culture change isn't something that you issue a statement on, right?
Right. Yes.
That's the other thing that you often see. It's like, right, we've got a culture initiative. We're going to paint everything different colors and
carbon
groups. No, it's a living, breathing thing.
That's it. And also, I think it can be as simple as the way in which you conduct meetings and allowing voices to be heard, right? That there's a multitude of ways. You can type it in. You can email me after. You can speak out loud, because not everybody wants to speak out loud. It's just being aware that not everybody fits, right? Reacts, responds, contributes in the exact same way.
Yeah. Asking people how they want to. And asking me twice, usually, as well. You know, the simple things like asking, "How are you?" And then when they say fine, asking again.
Right. Yeah.
And then opening up.
Yeah, exactly. So we're coming towards the end of our podcast today, Neil. And so I'd like to know, again, it sounds like it's been a journey professionally for you as well. And you've made great impact, but it's a journey, right? So if you were to share a piece of wisdom with your younger self, now that you are a sage, what would it be?
I think it is apologize later.
Oh, explain that. What do you mean by that?
So I've always I was nervous at first in a really large organization about following the rules and so on. But actually, sometimes the rules aren't defined. And if you can't find a rule that distinctly says no, and go and do it. So long as you know that you're not doing anything that would put the company in danger or that is ethically unsound or against the law, don't wait for someone to say yes, because in most organizations, there are plenty of people that will say no because they're not sure and they're too cautious.
Right.
Don't do it.
I love it. Apologize later. That is fantastic. Neil, what a pleasure it is to speak with you on behalf of the Employee Wellbeing Council. I'd like to thank you so much for your time and expertise.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Wellbeing Ignites Wellbeing podcast, brought to you by OOT Social Health. We hope today's conversation has sparked new insights and inspired you to prioritize well-being in your journey to organizational success. Remember, when well-being ignites, well-doing follows. Stay tuned for more episodes as we continue to explore the power of human-centric leadership. Until then, be well and lead with purpose.